Of Matthew. I believe I preached from here not too long ago. We're going to go over those same verses, but I've got a different thought this morning, although it does tie into what we preached a few weeks ago from here. But I want to take our reading from the fifth chapter of Matthew, and I'm going to start at the third verse. We're going to read down through the 13th verse. So starting at the third verse of the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is speaking. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they which mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men." Now, in the reading there, and we want to take our text from that 13th verse that says, "Ye are the salt of the earth." And that's what I want to talk about this morning. My thought is the salt of the earth. The salt of the earth. So I guess by way of introduction, as I usually do, I feel that we got to do a little bit of a history lesson. And that's simply because, again, we have to understand the impact of the picture that Jesus is painting for them. As we've talked about before, and you all are very well aware, that Jesus was the master teacher, and he did that by drawing from things of everyday life, things that people could readily get their hands on, and that conjured mental pictures. You know, they say a picture's worth a thousand words, and Jesus used that. He used words, just a few words, to create a mental picture of something that then could express a whole depth of an idea. And so many times having those mental pictures of something would help explain something in more depth than just trying to go through it line by line in a dissertation would. And we know that, you know, Jesus, he talked about everyday things. He talked about drawing water. He talked about fishing. He talked about sowing. He talked about reaping. He talked about, money. He talked about just all kinds of things every day. He talked about wine. He talked, you know, just everything that people would come into contact with every day. He used that as a backdrop to explain the things that he was trying to get across. And the same thing here, he's using a picture, and we need to be aware of that picture. And so we've got to understand a few things. He says that you are the salt of the earth. Now, we know what salt is, but salt doesn't have the same meaning to us that it has to those people at that time. It doesn't conjure the same image for us. The image, when I say salt, you all, I'm sure, just like me, you think of table salt. You think of that Epsom salt or whatever thing of salt you've got up in your cabinet. We might think of, the doctors told me to avoid salt. Salt's bad for blood pressure, whatever it might be. But those are the mental images that we have for salt. We might have some intellectual knowledge of salt beyond that, but that's the image that's conjured up in our mind. That's not the image that would have been conjured up in the minds of the people in Jesus' day and age. Salt in the ancient world, and really even in our world up until a couple hundred years ago, salt was life. As I began studying this and studying the history, I didn't realize really how integral that salt was to the growth of civilization. Every major civilization that you can pinpoint in the world grew up around some deposit of salt. It's so necessary for life. Now, of course, those that live close to the sea, they can get salt by evaporating the seawater, but that's not a very efficient way to get salt. To do that on a large scale, it takes lots of people, and it still has to be an industrial operation, even on a large scale. But salt is necessary for life, and it was so valuable in the ancient world that our word salary actually comes from the word salt. Now, there's some dispute among historians as to whether Roman soldiers, some people say that Roman soldiers at one time in history were paid in salt rather than in silver. Other historians say, well, no, that's not true. Actually, they were paid in silver, but it was for specifically a stipend to buy salt. I don't know, but the point is salt was very important. Now, what I can tell you is that, even closer to our history, just a couple hundred years ago, when Thomas Jefferson was proposing that the federal government fund the Lewis and Clark expedition west, one of his main points was that there were reports and there's reasons to believe a great large mountain of salt west of the Missouri River that would be invaluable. An invaluable resource for the fledgling United States. That was one of his main driving factors that got Congress to authorize the Lewis and Clark expedition, is the fact that they might find this large deposit of salt, because salt was still so important. During the War of 1812, I said I don't know if Roman soldiers were paid in salt, but American soldiers were paid in salt during the War of 1812, because United States was so strapped for cash, and salt was so valuable. That's what I want us to understand, that salt was valuable. Why? Because it was necessary for life. And so when we see, salt in our mind, it's just a condiment that's on our table. It's just a thing that we add to our food or we don't, that's up in the cupboard. And it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We don't place any value on it. If I told you I was going to pay you in salt, you would laugh because it doesn't have that kind of value in our society. But in the ancient world particularly, it had great value. As I said, every civilization was dependent upon salt. I read one scholar that said, once you get away from the oceans, that the animals would find natural salt licks and they would make animal trails. And then men would follow them and they would become roads. And then the roads led, and then cities would grow up around these salt deposits. And that's really where roads and cities in the ancient world came from, was based around salt, because it was so necessary. So understand what this is that Jesus is comparing his disciples to, is this thing that is of great value in the world that they were in. I also want us to note that, I've probably mentioned before here, as Jesus starts this Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, and we're going to talk about them maybe a little bit here, but he's speaking to a mixed multitude. There's true disciples, there's people that are questioning, there's outright scoffers, there's just all kinds of people gathered around that Jesus is speaking to. So it's very much a mixed multitude, and he's talking about the kingdom of heaven. And again, I preached a few weeks ago, primarily on the third verse here, and I was talking about how that Jesus is trying to present to them a radical view of what the kingdom is, that it's not like what they thought that it was going to be, but rather it's going to be like this. And he's presenting this very new to them and radical view of the kingdom. But again, it's a mixed multitude. And as you can imagine, he's preaching to this mixed multitude of people, probably conversations going on in the background and people that are scoffing at him and, all these different things going on in this large multitude, you can imagine. And he lays out the, saying these radical things that they've never heard, blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, all these things. And then he gets there in the 13th verse, he focuses his attention upon the true disciples, those that are truly saved in that multitude, those that truly believe the things that He is saying, those that truly know the Father, that have an understanding. He's explaining the kingdom to them, but that's resonating with their soul because they have had an experience with God. They've got an indwelling of the Holy Spirit. And so they're saved. And Jesus, at the end, He focuses His attention on them. And they realize, you know, that it's them that He's talking to. He says, ye, not all of you, but ye that understand what I'm talking about. You that understand what I mean about being poor and meek mourning seeking after righteousness and all those things. You that understand that, you're the salt of the earth. You're the most valuable thing that there is in the earth. Needed for life, necessary for life. That's what he's getting to them. That's what the message would have been. That you are this valuable thing, salt of the earth. We still have that connotation sometimes when we're talking about a certain person that we think highly of, and we might say, yeah, that he or she is their salt of the earth. Usually what we mean is that they're just regular person, nothing ostentatious about them, but they're just good people, hard workers, honest, forthright, all that. It's kind of what we mean, but this is what it comes back to. Those are the most valuable people in the world, aren't they? Those that go to work every day, that keep the country and the nation and society moving forward, and they're not lauded in the newspapers, and people don't know their names, and people may not aspire to be them, but they're the ones that keep everything running on a daily basis, and they give you the shirt off their back, and they do anything for you, and you trust them with your lives and your children's lives. We say those people are the salt of the earth. Well, that's where that idea comes back to here. But I want you to understand, it was very forward in their minds how important and valuable salt was. All right, we beat that to death. Let me get to what this means. What this means. So what made salt so valuable? What made salt so valuable? Well, it had several uses, but I want to boil it down to just three main things. And the first and foremost use of salt, particularly then, and some people use it for that now, is preservation. Preservation. Remember, this was a time before refrigeration. They lived in a hot climate. It didn't get very cold in the wintertime. You know, you could, even where we live in Tennessee, you could slaughter a hog in the fall. And lay it up in the cellar. You probably still salt it, but it's cold enough under the ground in a cellar. It'll preserve a little bit. Not like that over there in that area. It was hot and dry, and so we know that meat very quickly spoils. You know, I've got we've got a few goats and a few chickens out there, and some of you have farmed and familiar with animal, right? I would not take a handful of salt and go dump it on the heads of any of my goats. Why? Because it wouldn't do any good. They're alive. They're alive. They don't need the salt. But as soon as there is death, as soon as you slaughter that animal, as soon as it dies, the flesh begins to decay. It begins to decay. It begins to die. And salt is used to preserve, to stave off the decay of death. You take that meat and you salt it. And I'm no expert on this. I only know things I've read, so I don't know how to do it. But the salt, it leaches out the moisture, which helps cause the decay, and it will preserve that meat. And so it was very necessary in that day and age, and particularly in that climate. How do you preserve meat that you've hunted? Do you have to rely on hunting year round or farming it year round, or can we lay it up? Can we slaughter and lay it up and preserve that food? And so it was necessary for preservation. And I want you to understand that that is the primary way that Christians, that the people of God, are salt in this world. This world is dead. It's dying. It's decaying, just like the carcass of a dead animal. And it will very quickly rot away to nothing if it is not preserved. And Jesus has left His people here. You and I, Christians, Christians, people of God, to preserve this world for preservation. Do you understand that the only reason that the world continues to turn is for the sake of God's elect? We are here to preserve this dead and dying world. Let me give you some examples of a dead and dying world. God looked down there at one point in that antediluvian world, and He saw, it says that the earth was filled with wickedness. That there was wickedness everywhere. Every man did according to his own heart. He chased after wickedness, and only Noah was found grace in the eyes of the Lord. There was no salt left, just a couple little grains, Noah and his family, and it was not sufficient to preserve the world anymore. Just this one family that was still salt, Noah couldn't do the job. God said, I'm going to go down and I'm going to destroy everything. But even then, He left time, didn't He? He sent Noah out there and said, I want you to build that ark. And there was Noah out there in front of the world, in front of God, in front of all his neighbors and everybody passing by, building this big old ark for 120 years, telling everybody, God, it's going to rain. God is going to destroy the earth because of your wickedness. He was salt. He was trying to preserve. God was using every bit of him. Now, none of them listened, but that's not Noah's fault. And that's not God's fault. That's their fault. They didn't listen. But I want you to understand that Noah was there. He was left there. Even for that 120 years, even in the face of all of impossibility, as a preserving agent, he alone, his faithfulness alone, preserved the world another 120 years from when God said He was going to destroy it. Again, none got saved except his family, but that's not God's fault. But he preserved. The world was preserved another 120 years just because of Noah, the salt of the earth that Noah was. Yes, we're here to preserve the world. Remember Sodom and Gomorrah, and the sin of those cities came up before God's eyes. And He said, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to destroy it. And then He went by and He visited with Abraham. And God said, shall I hide from Abraham, my friend, what I'm about to do? He said, no, I'm not going to do that. And He tells Abraham, I'm on my way down to Sodom and Gomorrah to destroy it because of the sins of those cities. Now, Abraham knew that those cities were full of sin, but he had pity upon those people. And you know the story. He said, God, would you save them for 50? And he said, I'd save them for 50. Well, God, what if they lack 10? Would you kill them for the lack of 10? Would you do it for 40? And he got all the way down to 10. And God said, I'll preserve the city. If there's a salt of 10 people, if there's enough salt of 10 Christians, of course, they weren't Christians then. They were people of God, though. If there's 10 saved people there, I'll preserve the whole city. And we know they didn't find 10, and God rained fire and brimstone upon those cities. But the principle holds that just a little bit of salt, if there had just been a little bit of salt there to preserve, God would have stayed His hand even in the face of that great wickedness. God has set His people here to be salt, to preserve this earth. Look over in Isaiah, 1st chapter, 9th verse. Now, Isaiah was writing during the time of the Assyrian uprising. The Assyrian Empire was running rampant in the Middle East, and they were putting everybody to the sword, conquering everybody. And they were in the process of conquering the northern kingdom of Israel at the time. And there was concern in Jerusalem and in Judea of what was going to happen at this Assyrian threat. So it's with this backdrop of enemies pressing down upon them and the great sin of the people that Isaiah prophesies. In the first chapter of the 9th verse, Isaiah says, except the Lord of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah.
Isaiah tells the people, the greater part of Israel that was not saved, and you all know that, I preached that before, but I'll mention it again because it bears remembering, because a great part of the Christian world doesn't understand this. They still think that Israel somehow got saved different in the Old Testament than we get saved today, and I'll tell you, it's the same way. It's never changed. People from Adam down to us have always been saved individually by faith in God, by believing God. Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. And yes, God called Israel out collectively as his people, and he gave them the law and the covenants and the sacrifices and all of those things. But I'm telling you, every single individual Israelite, man and woman, still had to believe individually, personally, upon God and be saved individually and personally. And it was never a majority. It was never a majority that were saved. There was more or less at any given time, but it was never a majority. And sometimes it was very, very few. And Isaiah is telling all of Israel, he says, were it not for, except the Lord of, and he even, it wasn't even the remnant. The remnant didn't do it on their own. He says, the Lord of God left us a very small remnant. Now, you know, a remnant is just a part. You know, if I took a piece of cloth off this jacket and tore it off, we would say that's a remnant of the jacket, right? It's what's left. It's just a small piece. He said, if God himself hadn't left a small remnant that were truly saved, a small remnant of righteous and just and God-fearing people, he said, we would all be as Sodom and Gomorrah. We'd all be destroyed. You understand what he's saying? He's telling Israel, God's people that are puffed up in pride there. Isaiah's dealing with those prideful Jews in Jerusalem and Judea, thinking that they can do whatever they want because they're God's people and they've got the temple and God's never going to destroy them. He says, listen, if it weren't for the salt, that little bit of salt that God left with the remnant, we'd all already be destroyed. He said, the only reason you're here is because of the preserving power of God's remnant. That's the only thing that's kept you here. That's true then, and it's true today. Were it not for, if the Lord of hosts had not left a very small remnant of which we can be joyous that we're part of, if God had not left a very small remnant, the whole world would be as Sodom and Gomorrah. It was that small remnant. You remember back Elijah. And it was before Isaiah. You know, he's remembering back, I think. Isaiah's pulling back from there. Elijah, and he had that great victory up on Mount Carmel. And then, he fell into a depression. And he's out in the desert. He's in the cave. And God shows up. And what are you doing here, Elijah? He says, I'm the only one left. And he's feeling sorry for himself. And he says, I'm the only one left. They've all forsaken you, Lord. And now they seek my life. And what did the Lord tell him? He said, I have 7,000. I have 7,000. That have not bowed a knee unto Baal. Now, 7,000 was a small remnant out of all Israel at that time. I don't know how big Israel was. Probably at least 2-3 million. I mean, they were 2 million at least when they come out of the wilderness. So 2 or 3 million, 7,000. That's a small remnant. But God even then had a small remnant. It was that 7,000 that kept the whole nation afloat. They were the salt, the preserving power of God's elect. When he tells us we're the salt, that's our first job, is to preserve this world. Over in Matthew, Jesus gives an illustration of this in the 13th chapter of Matthew. This is the parable of the wheat and the tares. Starting in the 27th verse, he says, so the servants of the householder came and said unto him, sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? And he said unto them, an enemy hath done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let them both grow together until the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say unto the reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles and burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. Now you all know, Jesus then explains that parable later on, and we know that the field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom, and the bad seed are the children of the devil, the tares. And so we've got saved people, and we've got lost people, and they're growing up together. And the servant said, Lord, should we go dig up the tares, root them out right now? And he said, no, let them grow together for the sake of the wheat. You know, well, I've tried my hand at gardening and I'm not very good. Usually because I start out real good and then I fade just as the weeds start growing up. And then, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of being lazy and you look up and the weeds have started to take over. And you go out there and when you got a lot of weeds around, if you're not real careful, as you're trying to dig out those weeds, you can damage the roots of the plant. I've done that too, because then I get in a hurry and I just start ripping stuff out and I rip out the good plants too. And that's what the master said. No, don't go rip out the tares because you might damage some of the good wheat. Let's just let them grow together. Then we'll harvest it all together and we'll sort it out at the end. Listen, it's because of God's wheat, that's you and I that are saved, that's the elect, that God is sparing the whole world. He said, we'll sort it out at the end. But were it not for the wheat, he'd burn the whole field down. We're here to preserve. We're here to preserve. How? But how? How do we go about doing that? He said, you're the salt of the earth. And the first thing that would have come to mind to those people is the preserving power, the preserving necessity of salt. Salt was necessary to preserve. This world must be preserved, but how? How are we to do it? Well, Jesus had just told them in the Beatitudes how to do it. He had just told them in the Beatitudes how to do it. We, as God's children, must live morally excellent lives. We've got to live morally excellent lives. That's what Jesus is talking about. He said, be poor in spirit. Mourn. Mourn for what? Mourn for the sin that's in the world. Mourn for the godlessness that's in the world. Mourn for the pain and the darkness that's in the world. Yes, we should be a mourning people. The more that we see sin abounding in the world and men and women turn their backs upon God, and then we see the effects of sin in our communities and in our schools and all around us, and we can look and we can say, oh, if it were not for sin, this would not be happening. Oh, if people would just turn to God, this would not be happening. And that's true. And we ought to mourn that. Meek. Hunger after righteousness. We ought to be a people hungering after the righteousness of God in our lives. Thirsting to be more and more like God, more and more like Jesus, to shine brighter and brighter with the glory of God, with His moral perfection. Yes, we'll never get there. We'll never be morally perfect, but we ought to be thirsting and hungering after righteousness. That will lead us to being merciful in a world that has no mercy. In a world that's run by the devil, where the vast majority of the people are children of the devil, whether they know it or not. And there's no mercy with him. And there's no mercy in this merciless world. But yet we are to have mercy, to be a merciful people. Blessed are the pure in heart. The pure in heart. Now, nobody's pure in heart. We know that. We've got sin to contend with. But if you've been saved, you've got a pure part of you. You've got a part of you, I know I do, that longs after God. Longs for a day when this sinful flesh will be put away. Longs for a day that I can see my Savior face to face. As Job said, with the skin worms devour me. With these eyes I shall behold my Redeemer. There's a part in every child of God that yearns for that, yearns to see God. And he said, those that have that pureness of heart, they will see God. They will see God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. So he's gone through all of these things, but I want us to understand what Jesus is talking about through all of that is moral excellence. Listen, God is morally perfect. He expects, He desires His people to have moral excellence. How else can we preserve a world that is awash in immorality, that is awash in unrighteousness, that is awash in everything that is counter to God, everything that God hates, they love? How can we preserve it unless we uphold moral excellence? Not pointing out their failures, but trying to uphold it in our own lives. We have got to live out these things that Jesus is talking about. That's how we can have a preserving effect upon the world. Because as the world spirals more and more and more out of control, and people's lives become darker and darker, and sin abounds more and more, eventually people get to they say, whoa, this isn't working, and they start looking around for something that's different. And what do they do if they can't find anything? That's where we're supposed to be. Then the church is supposed to shine out in that moment. You can picture it. The clouds of darkness surrounding the world, and people that are lost in their own sin and their own unrighteousness and their opposition to God, and they're just floundering around in this darkness. And all of a sudden, one by one or in small groups, they begin, there's got to be something different. There's got to be something different. Everything that the world is teaching me, everything I've been trying to follow, it's leading nowhere. It's leading to destruction. People have moments of clarity, and they look for something. And it's at that moment that we can imagine they look up, and then shining through that darkness is a light coming from some little church somewhere, some little flock that's been planted by the Master's hand in that community, in that area. Maybe it's a job place where you're the only one, or you're one of a few, or you have some opportunity where you're at as an individual child of God to be that light as people that you know that are struggling in this world because of their unrighteousness. And they're struggling. I need something different. And there we can be as God's children, shining out to them, not our own perfection, but God's perfection reflected in us. But if we don't live, if our lives are just like theirs, and we're just as messed up, and we got just as much black clouds hanging over us, how are we going to do any preserving work? And that leads us to the next point, is that we've got to lift up Jesus. We've got to be in the business of lifting up Jesus Christ. He said, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. When we hold Jesus up as the answer, because we know, if you've been saved, you're a child of God. You know Jesus is the answer. I don't care what the question is that somebody has. Jesus is the answer, isn't He? It doesn't matter what your question is. If you've got a question, Jesus is the answer. If you've got a problem, alcohol, drugs, families falling apart, work problems, problems in your own life, anger issues, I don't care what it is, I can confidently tell anybody, Jesus is the answer. But listen, they're not going to listen to me if they don't see something different in me. They're not going to listen to you if they don't see something different in you. How are God's people supposed to do what He's put us here to do if people won't listen to us when we have the opportunity to say, Jesus? Because if we're standing there pointing to Jesus and they're looking and saying, you ain't any better than me. Your life's not any better than me. You got the same problems and you face them the same way. Your life's in the toilet the same way my life's in the toilet. Why should I believe you? Why not go down to the guy that's saying Buddha or saying Muhammad or saying whatever else? The truth of it was when they see something different, when they see that moral excellence shining through in our lives, and then they say, Why are you so different? Why is all this craziness not affecting you the same way? Yeah, you're suffering the vagaries of life, and you've got bad things happen to all of us. The same bad things are happening to you in life, but you're still cheerful, and you're still compassionate, and you're still merciful, and you're still loving, and you're still all of these things. How is that happening? Then you can say, let me tell you about Jesus. That's why it's happening. That's why my life is different, because of Jesus. You see, those things go together. Lifting up Jesus and moral excellence goes together. That's why Jesus was always trying to instruct His disciples about the need for living righteously. Because nobody's going to believe the message that we have of Jesus if the message bearer is stuck down in the muck and mire like everybody else. And finally, the how, our moral character, our moral excellence. We have to lift up Jesus, and we have to be ready, willing, and able to suffer some persecution. We have to be willing and able to suffer some persecution. Think about when that salt has done its best work of preserving. And by preserving, I mean actually bringing back to life. It does more, doesn't it? We do more than preserve. We can, through Jesus Christ brings people back to life. I want you to think about the times when the church and God's people were doing a lot of preserving. That first generation church, the first two or three centuries as Christianity spread throughout the ancient world. What was accompanying that spread? Persecution. It was persecution. They were having a great effect, turning the world upside down, but they were being persecuted for it. And oh, we'll be persecuted for it too. We might show forth, for every we show forth moral excellence in our lives and point to Jesus Christ, for every one person that affects positively, that it turns them, helps turn them to Jesus, helps get them to the gospel and to salvation, there'll be two or three that hate us for it. That hate us for it. That's just the way it is. Jesus said, if they hate the master, they'll hate you too. We see the examples of that throughout the Bible. So we, as the salt of the earth, we must be willing and able and ready to suffer some persecution. Because if we're really doing the job of preserving, there's a lot of people out there that don't want to hear that they need preserve. They don't want to hear that their life's messed up. They don't want to hear that they need some moral character. They don't want to hear that they need to turn away from sin. And they surely don't want to hear that they have to bow down and cry out and repent unto Jesus Christ. And they'll hate us for it. But Paul says about that over in 2 Timothy, and you all have heard me say this before. In the 11th, or 3rd chapter and 11th verse, he says, persecutions, afflictions, which have come to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra, what persecutions I endured, but out of them all the Lord delivered me. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. That's what Paul said about it. It's part and parcel of being salt in this world for the Lord Jesus Christ. And so that's how do we preserve? How do we go about our job of preserving? We've got to first strive for moral excellence in our lives. Why? Because it pleases God. Number one, it pleases God. That's what He wants for His children. He hath before ordained us unto good works that we should walk in them. And only through that moral excellence will we be able to convincingly point the world to Jesus Christ. See, He's the one that made me different. You see, you understand that I'm a little bit different than you. It's not me. As Paul would say, it's nothing in me. But it's Christ Jesus. Let me tell you about my Jesus that has done that. And He's willing to do that for you. That's how we preserve this world. And then be ready. Be ready for every one that will listen. There'll be two or three that'll hate you for it. We've got to keep on keeping on. To preserve, that's one of the main things that salt does. You know something else that salt does, and we use it for this primarily, is flavor. We use it for flavor. When I reach for the salt on my table, it's not usually to preserve something. It's to add some flavor to the food. And God has set us here to add flavor to this world. To add flavor to this world. For who? Flavor for who? For God Himself. For God Himself. This world, I've said before and tried to get us to understand, and some of you that might be students of history know this, and if you don't, if you only know the history that you learned in high school and what you see on the History Channel, then you're missing out on some of the truth. And the truth of the matter is that the world, prior to Jesus Christ showing up on the scene, was a very dark and wicked place. Everywhere. Everywhere. Now, probably the greatest civilizations at that time, the Greek and the Roman civilizations, they looked with horror at other places in the world. And the violence and the death and the the sacrifice that they would the human sacrifices that went on, and it was just a horrible, dark place. The Romans and the Greeks thought that, but listen, let me tell you, the Romans and the Greeks, what we know about them is, we learn about Aristotle and Plato and maybe Cicero and a few of the Caesars, and we learn about Greek law or Greek philosophy and Roman law and all those good things. Listen, that was about this much of Greek and Roman society. The rest of it was dark. It was dark and horrible. It was a place without mercy. It was a place that had there was no pity. Those that were children that were born with any kind of physical or mental deformity were exposed and left to die, and mostly they did. And if they didn't die, somebody might take them in and turn them into a slave. That's about the best they could hope for. A person that found themselves disabled through war, they were cast aside. Disabled through whatever, they were cast aside. Usually died very quickly because nobody had mercy on them. Nobody had pity on them. That's not something you all read about the gladiatorial combats. People lusted for blood. I mean, it was a dark, dark place. And that was in the most light places, which was in Greek and Roman society. You get further away from there and it was darker and darker and more wicked. That was the world before Jesus Christ came on the scene. Now, fast forward today and we look at the world that we live in today. Do you understand that every good thing in this world is a product of Christianity? Were it not that, I was talking to the kids at school here on Friday. I don't know how we got off onto this, but I was talking to them and trying to get them to understand. I said, you all might think that, here in America, largely influenced by most of the Western world is largely influenced by Christianity over the last 1500 years, although you don't see much Christianity today, but we're heavily influenced, and that's what people don't realize. That we take for granted in America and in the West that, we believe that you should help those that are helpless, that you should have pity upon the poor and the sick and the disabled and children and widows, and that we should do something to take care of them personally and as a society. I mean, we generally all agree on those things, whether we do that or not, but we would agree that that is a good thing to do. Listen, that's not a natural part of the human character or psyche. I've been places in the world where there is none of that. Not one person thinks that way. Places where the light of Christianity has never shined, or where it shined 1,000 years ago, but that light was snuffed out for whatever reason. And I'm telling you that in other places of the world that have never experienced Christianity on a large scale, they don't think like that. They are still merciless and dark and without pity and without compassion and violent. The rest of the world is like that. And the farther away from the influences of Christianity they are, the more they're like that. I mean, in the dark parts of Africa, they're still butchering each other with machetes and eating children. Yes, I know that's graphic, but it happens. It's happening today in parts of the world. The whole world was like that before Christ and before Christianity. I want you to understand how the flavor of this world has changed because of Christianity. Again, the very fact that I don't worry about somebody breaking into my house. Oh, it could happen, but statistically it's very rare. I don't worry about my wife when she walks down the street or goes to the store that she's going to be raped or my children are going to be murdered. I don't worry about that, and neither do you. We have Christianity to thank for that. It's not like that in a lot of places in the world. They do worry about those things. And in the ancient world, they did worry about those things. You know why Rome was so great? Why it was such a great empire at the time? Not because they were full of mercy and compassion, but they brought Roman law. And they applied that law, as harsh as it was, to the highest and to the least. And they established some order so that, yes, it was a dark place, but at least you could walk from point A to point B and not be raped or murdered, probably under Roman law. And that was a great change from what things were like. And I know, and I don't want this to be a history lesson, but I want us to understand, because our history, the history of Christianity in the West, has been rewritten by godless people, and they don't want you to understand. They want you to think that all the benefits and all the compassion and all the mercy and everything that is good in Western society has somehow come through the great thinkers of the Enlightenment, and that is a lie. It's come through Christianity. Christianity, the children of God have flavored the world, and without it, it would be a dark and miserable place still. And we're still here to do that. We're still here to do that as we see the world slipping back away, as we see the dark forces that are ever present when men turn away from God, as we see those clouds gathering, and we see civility and mercy and compassion and goodness slipping through our fingers in our very society that we live in, we are still to be the flavor. We are still to be the influence for something better. Were it not for the salt that Jesus left, the world would still be a dark place. And even in a place like America, where the vast majority of people have turned their backs upon God, we have a functioning society that values somewhat mercy and compassion and all of those things. Because of Christianity, because of what Jesus left here, because of the salt that has been left here for 2,000 years. And we're still called to do that, to be a force for making this world better. Again, through our lives and through our example and through our love for Jesus Christ. I got to move on. Finally, salt produces thirst, doesn't it? You sit down, you eat that. I love ham. I can eat me some ham. But you know what happens after you eat a big plate full of ham? A couple hours later, you just can't get enough water, right? That salt makes you thirsty. It creates thirst. And there's reasons for that, because salt's doing important things in our body. It's putting the water in the cells and the places that it needs to be. But it creates a thirst. The presence of God's children in this world should create a thirst for God among people. A thirst for God among people. People should begin to have a desire to have what we have. When they see us in this world truly following God the way that we ought to be, it should create a thirst and a desire in others to have the thing that we have. Yes, a thirst for God. That's what we are here to create. That's what Israel, I've said before, you know, they were to be a city on a hill, to create among those pagan societies that there were that lived around them, that they would look to Israel and look at what Israel had, the blessings that they were receiving for God, and that they would thirst after that. They would say, how do we get what you've got? I'm thirsty for the blessings that you have. Tell me about this God, Jehovah, Yahweh. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be following God and reaping spiritual blessings from God, which we will if we follow Him. Maybe not material blessings, but spiritual blessings. And people should be looking and seeing that in us and then thirsting after the God that we have, that we can point them to. Yes, that's what we're to be as salt. And the last part, he says, but if the salt has lost its flavor, it is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under the foot of men. Now again, this is a picture that we can't quite understand. My table salt and yours, it never loses its flavor, does it? It can set up in the cabinet. However long you pull it out, it's going to do its job. The salt that they had was not like that. What we have is pure sodium chloride, purified through man-made processes, and it's pure sodium chloride. What they had was not pure. Particularly in the Middle East, they mined it out of caves. They would get it out of swamps, and it was what we would call rock salt. Mixed with lots of impurities, mixed with sand and dirt and all kinds of other things. And the it was particularly susceptible to losing its saltiness when it was stored. And they would, remember, so they would bring it in large quantities and sometimes store it up. When it came in contact with the ground, when it came into too much direct sunlight contact, contact with moisture, it would, the salt, the, and now we know this now, they didn't know. We know that the salt, the sodium chloride, is water soluble and it will melt away with water. Now imagine this rock salt that they had, similar to what we would consider rock salt. It could come in contact with moisture and the salt, the Na, the sodium chloride, could leach out of it, but the crystalline structure was still there. It looked the same. It still looked like that piece of rock salt that was put in there, but when you go to use it, it doesn't have any saltiness left because it's been leached out by the ground, by the moisture, by rain, by sunlight. That was quite prevalent in their day. If you didn't store it with much care, it could lose its salt. It still looked the same. It had the same outward appearance. You'd take it and you'd try to use it, and it didn't do the job because it had lost its saltiness. And then it was good for nothing but to be cast under the foot of men. See, the funny thing about it is it lost all of its salting character, but it still, if you put it out on your field, your field would be barren. You couldn't do anything with it. Once it had lost that saltiness, it wasn't good to preserve anything. It wasn't good to create thirst. It wasn't good to flavor. And you couldn't, nobody wanted it, they didn't want it out in the field, they didn't want it anywhere because it would still kill any vegetation. And so what they would literally do is take it and throw it out in the roads and the footpaths, because that's where there was already nothing growing, and just be trampled underfoot. That's all it was good for. It had nothing left. You know, there's nothing as useless as a backslidden Christian. Devil can't have them. God can't use them. Useful for nothing. I've been there. A child of God that's not serving God is about the most miserable thing that there is, because they're good for nothing. Good for nothing. Not at home in this world and not able to be used by God because they're backslidden. And so what happens to this world if we lose our saltiness? We're good for nothing to be cast out and trodden underfoot. But what happens to the world? Not just what happens to me when I compromise my relationship with God, when I lose my saltiness, I'm not any good for anybody anymore. And then neither are you. But then if that happens to all of us, what happens to the world? Again, look at those places. I have been in places in the Middle East where there used to be, at least according to the letters in Revelation, there were thriving Christian communities. There was salt. Somewhere along the way, enough of them lost their saltiness, and I don't know what all happened, and wars and famines and displacements of peoples and whatever, but there's no light there now. And oh, how dark a place it is for the people that are left without the salt among them. It's a dark, dark place for those people that have been deprived of the salt. If we don't do what we're supposed to do, yes, it will affect our relationship with God. We won't have as close a walk as we ought to. We won't have as much joy in this life as we could have. We won't have as much fulfillment in this life as we should have, and we will have if we're following God. But I want us to think about the consequences to the rest of the world if we don't do what we're put here to do. Let me leave you. I talked about Lot. Lot was a perfect example of salt that had lost its savor, wasn't he? There he was in the midst of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham thought, well, Lot's down there. Surely there's 10 righteous. Surely there's 10 righteous down there. But Lot, because of his own love of the world, he didn't lose his salvation, but he lost his saltiness. He lost his saltiness such that that whole city, those cities could have been preserved if Lot had just done a little bit, had just witnessed a little bit. Those whole cities could have been preserved. Not only did those cities get lost, his own children, He lost his own married daughters because he had lost his saltiness to such a degree that when he went out there and he told his sons-in-law, he said, the Lord's going to destroy this place. We've got to flee. They look at him like a crazy person. They thought he was mad. He'd lost his witness to such a degree that they just didn't believe anything that he had to say, wouldn't come with him, and his daughters presumably perished there with their husbands that wouldn't leave. He lost his wife because her heart was still back in Sodom. Oh, what a terrible, terrible price that Lot paid. But again, I want us to see not just the personal price that he paid, but that whole city, two cities, that whole could have been preserved a little while longer if Lot had not lost his saltiness. We have got a great responsibility, folks, as God's people. We've got a great responsibility to this lost and dying world. We're the thing that's standing between them and judgment right now. We're the thing that's pointing them to Jesus. We're the thing that's preserving them from the wrath of God right now. Because Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth. But if we lose our saltiness, and we're not good for anything, and we get cast out, what happens to everyone around us, all these lost and dying souls around us, if we don't do what we're supposed to do, if we lose our saltiness? So that's where I want to leave it. Are we preserving? Are we doing our jobs as a preservation agent in this world? Are we flavoring this world? Are we flavoring this world with Christian morals, Christian ethics, a Christian worldview, Christian compassion, Christian mercy? You say, well, I can't go out and change the world. No, but we can all flavor our little surrounding a little bit that way, can't we? And are we creating a thirst in others to know the God that has saved us, the God that rules over our lives? If we're doing those things, then we're doing what Jesus has called us to do. But if we're not, we risk losing our saltiness, and then we'll not be good for anything. We'll not be good for anything. And so, we are the salt of the earth. Let us do what must be done as the salt of the earth. I appreciate you listening. Brother Dyer, if we get a song.